All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome to episode 16 of the SLS Cast. I don't have anything funny to say. That was just...
I don't either. Just 1-6.
Very cool.
It's a very awkward... I don't remember my 16th year of life. Do you? Do you remember yours? Anything exciting happened?
Oh, yes. 16 was a good year. There was a lot of craziness going on.
It was a good year.
It was my own summer of 69 and all that good stuff, so.
Yeah, what year was it in when you were 16?
Let's just suffice it to say it was 20 years ago. Yeah.
1993.
Yeah. How sad is that? I'm just an old fogey now. That's me. Old fogey.
Yeah. Well, I've had a interesting past week. Been to a couple movie screenings. Went and saw the new G.I. Joe. And last night I went and saw Evil Dead at their advanced screening. And I got to tell you, you definitely have to go see it. It is, and bring your kids with you. It's the best family film of this year. I think I'm gonna say. After the movie, they'll look up at you. They'll say, "Thank you, Daddy. I'm glad you took me to go see this."
Well, my only question, since this was an advanced screening of Evil Dead, what did you happen to see? Bruce Campbell or Sam Raimi?
A lot of us were thinking that they'd do like a Q&A, but they didn't. However, I don't want to say anything until anybody sees it, because I'm not even going to say review into those who've already kind of seen my mini review on GoFobo or anything like that. Just try to look away if it ever comes up. But just make sure you stay till after the credits as well. Just
cool.
Saying.
Oh, yeah, this was a no-brainer for me. I'm definitely going to see this movie, so I can't wait. I am super stoked to see this play.
Stoked.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and leave your kids at home. Make sure you leave them at home.
Nope, too late. Taking them. I'm actually just my 3-year-old. I'm just going to take the 3-year-old. You know, it's great. So, at any rate, how you been doing there, Mr. Tim?
Doing pretty well. I got a little scratchy throat the past couple days. Had a scratchy throat the past couple days, so pardon me if it sounds like I'm, you know, talking with a few cough balls. Why is it cough balls? Mothballs. Kind of stuck in my esophagus.
Ah,
my
esophageal
unit.
Outstanding. At least you're sure about what they are. Mothballs.
I'm positive.
Yes, that's awesome. And of course, unfortunately, our Mikey, is actually his birthday today, so he, as we record, so he was unable to join us, because he's being taken out to a wonderful birthday dinner, with his lovely girlfriend, and I'm hoping
to the Sizzler, I think.
Yes, well, just as long as there's birthday sex for him at the end of the night, then I guess, you know, I'd be fine with Burger King. If I knew that I had birthday sex coming, whatever. You know, I figure the faster we get through dinner, the sooner I get to the birthday sex. So this is just me. Maybe other people like to draw it out. I don't know.
Will you have Gorilla playing in the background?
That would be the one time I think I could do that. Would be, you know, actually it would have to be one step further. It would have to just be birthday sex day, you know. So that would be this way. It's just forget the Sizzler, forget the Burger King. It's just all day sex romp. Happy birthday to me. At which point you can play just about any song you want.
And I wonder if what's his name, the guy who sings that song,
Bruno Mars.
Yeah, Bruno Mars. I kind of wonder if, like, with Marvin Gaye as well. Though I'm not wanting to lump them in the same talent, you know, bracket.
Sure.
But I wonder if Marvin Gaye put, like, you know, whenever he's trying to woo a woman, if he puts on his own album while he's trying to do so.
Well, you mean know? Put, because past tense, right?
Put.
Marvin Gaye is dead.
Yeah. Yeah, if he had put. If he had put. I don't know, he might have like a record player with all his records in the grave. Unless he was cremated, then
I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think it's kind of, it's one of those just severe twists of irony, really, when it comes to Marvin Gaye. I feel really bad for the guy in one sense, because he definitely did not deserve to die the way he did, okay? But this is a guy who sang, you know, Mercy Me, The Ecology, and, you know, he was always... songs, you know, he had songs about love and peace and, you know, and trying to take care of the planet and all this kind of stuff. And then he dies because he got in, essentially, in a shooting match with his dad. And his dad shot him and killed him. So, kind of ironic there. And
I wonder, you know, they had to have played one of his songs as they, you know, the casket was lowered if he was buried. I just wonder which song they would have chosen for it. You know, Let's Get It On.
I don't know. That's a there's a lot of maybe
it's
You're All I Need to Get By.
Lowering, you know, his music comes on, and
you know,
women throwing themselves.
Well, I suppose if that's the case, women throwing themselves on the coffin, then maybe he could still choose some records in the afterlife. We are going down a dark path, and perhaps
maybe
we should stop.
News?
Yes!
Let's talk about some movie news.
Yes, movie news, movie news, movie news.
Do you want to go first?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Okay.
Okay, so, some fun stuff. Apparently, Hey You Guys asked Ryan Reynolds. They were doing a an interview with Ryan Reynolds and Emma Stone for The Croods, which a friend of mine who listens to the show actually told me he went and saw it the other day, and he said it was actually a pretty good flick, and it definitely is a good family flick. So I may or may not check it out. I got kids. We'll see. So they asked, so since they had Ryan Reynolds and Emma Stone in the same room, these Hey You Guys took the opportunity to ask them about their different comic book universes. And so apparently Stone talked about how she loves the Amazing Spider-Man 2 script, but what was really interesting is what Reynolds had to say about Deadpool. And basically, Reynolds is saying, quote, "It's up to the studio. The studio, I think, is reluctant to pull the trigger on such a hard rated R script. Then the guys who wrote it and the producers won't make it unless it's that hard and, you know, raunchy," end quote. So this tug of war will be very interesting to see how it turns out, because as we have discussed at length and ad nauseum before, PG-13 really does tend to have the widest available audience to see it, but typically waters things down for harder content, and the hardcore fans are usually let down by that. So, do you please the fans and potentially create a great franchise that will just be for adults, or do you pull it back and make it more mainstream and then risk ruining the franchise before it can take off at all?
Right, well, it's like with Dredd, I think, you know, the movie was a hard R, super violent. But it was made for the fans who didn't like Stallone's Judge Dredd. And you look at how it did poorly at the box office, but I remember you telling us a couple weeks ago, Matt, that it's doing really well on DVD sales and Blu-ray sales.
Yes.
So they can always just count on it, you know, them people buying the movie later on, then I don't know, I think you should always stick with the fan base, regardless if you might lose a little bit of money, or it might take a little while longer to, I guess, gain more money.
Indeed. I you know, and something else, of course, that was noted last year, Reynolds also said that the Deadpool movie would have no connection to the character that was in X-Men Origins Wolverine. And also that the budget would have to be, quote, "down enough where you can afford to take big risks and do most things that superhero movies can't do yet," end quote. So that might even just be just another little step in the right direction. So, you know,
50 Shades of Deadpool.
That's right. And hat tip to Screen Slam on that one. So there, that's always the fun stuff. Interestingly, from a Yahoo Sports blog called Cage Rider, there is actually a movie.
Screen Slam to Cage Rider.
Yes, yes, that's right. You know, that's how I roll, okay? So, apparently, there is a movie about Bruce Lee's most legendary fight in the works, okay? And the interesting thing is that they are just trying to focus on the fight itself, okay? The article says that for nearly 50 years, there has been much speculation and heated debate about what occurred inside of that gym, as very few people witnessed it. The upshot of the bout is that it helped to develop Lee's views on Jeet Kune Do, which is the forerunner of today's mixed martial arts, okay? And they are sourcing, now Yahoo's sourcing Deadline.com as having reported that a movie about the fight will be called Birth of the Dragon. And it's going to be produced by QED International and Groundswell Productions. So the fight, basically though, again, this is to focus specifically on the fight. This is not designed to be a biography of Lee. And it's not necessarily supposed to be a definitive account of the fight. All right? Mm-hmm. London is saying, and this is Groundswell CEO Michael London, is saying, he says, quote, we're actually not trying to retell the story of Bruce Lee. I think that's a natural impression people might get. The idea, actually, is to take that battle, which has been so mysterious and so powerful and so interesting to so many, and tell the lead-up to that story, which is Wong Jack Man's arrival in San Francisco, end quote. So this is definitely going to have its own tone. But one of the things that was interesting is that there are some people who are still alive today, like his wife, that was there. So they are going to be able to talk to at least one person and kind of get an idea of what's happening, of what really happened, and kind of construct it from there. So I'm actually interested in seeing something like this. Unfortunately, though, while the movie is supposed to be made, London said that there was no timetable to begin filming. He says, quote, if we're lucky, we'll make the movie next year, end quote. So what do you think? Is this a worthy movie to be made?
Probably. I mean, it seems like it can be done on a low budget. So, and there's obviously a fan base.
I would watch it.
Especially if you have Bruce Lee's name kind of.
Yeah, I would watch it. I think it would be, if it's done right. Well, of course, that's the thing with anyone. Well, if it's done right, it's going to be a good movie. I think that if they can accurately tell the story of the fight, while at the same time put together what's going through these guys' minds and going on in their lives as they come together for the fight, I think it really could make a compelling movie. So I would definitely be down to see this movie, and I am for it being
Chuck
made.
Norris be in it? The beardless Chuck Norris?
Well, again, that he's not part of this.
He should be.
He's the only person who ever beat him in competition.
I know. I'm kidding.
Oh, okay. Well, I was gonna, you know, maybe they could have a movie about that fight. I don't know. So, and the only reason Chuck Norris beat him was because it was a competition. So,
right.
If it was just going at it on the street, I'm pretty sure Chuck Norris would not have the legendary status that he has today.
Oh, probably not.
So, but finally, five film facts about The Gray. Okay, we reviewed The Gray about a month and a half ago, I guess.
The Gray, yes.
And of course, this is the plane that crashes in the tundra, and the wolves are after everybody. Liam Neeson, he's the badass, all that good stuff. So, here's some interesting things about this. All right, so number one, shooting took place on location in Smithers, British Columbia, about a 12-hour drive north of Vancouver. Okay, so of course, during the filming, temperatures in the mountains, they dip well below freezing, wind gusts upward of 80 miles an hour, complete whiteouts that forced the crew to stop shooting on three separate occasions, okay? The director, Joe Carnahan, who experienced partial frostbite on his fingers and toes, later mused, "I could have set the script in Tahiti with wild boars, but that didn't occur to me." another
those revelations kind of happen with a lot of movies like this.
Exactly.
You know, I could have done this.
Exactly.
Could have been on a beach and have crabs chasing us.
There you go. Now, to prepare himself for such extreme conditions, Neeson actually started taking freezing cold showers. He says, quote, "I remember seeing a documentary about a crazy Brit a few years ago, one of those crazy guys who swims in the Antarctic. And in London, he started his training by standing under freezing cold showers for 10 minutes every morning. So I thought, I'll do that," end quote. By the time shooting began, Neeson's glacial showers were up to 7 minutes.
Glacial showers.
Yes. So...
sounds cold.
Hey, but at least I guess it prepped him for wandering around without the coat and everything in those few scenes after the planes crashed, so...
yeah, it's like, I can see... This is another, like, notch on Liam Neeson's badass scale. Somebody can say, "I'm going to go take a shower." "What kind of shower are you going to take?" "A cool shower." "Well, I'm going to go take a glacial shower."
I'm surprised they just didn't do the Harry Houdini
shower. It will feel like a frickin' glacial, damn it, thing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm surprised you just didn't go the Harry Houdini route and just take a literal ice bath, you know, or you just go and sit in a bathtub and have, you know, buckets of ice cubes thrown on you.
Well, that usually happens only in deep down in the South when you're dying of heat stroke is when they put you in the... that or when you're ODing.
True, I'm just... but it's also a way to acclimate yourself to freezing cold temperatures, so...
Right.
Now,
have you ever done that?
Do what?
Have you ever done that?
No. I have no reason to do that. About the best I can ever say is back when I was a kid, teenager... 13, 14, I would, you know, it was my job as the oldest boy to mow the lawn and stuff. And of course, in the summers in Florida and in Texas or whatever, you know, it gets really hot. So I would mow the lawn and everything and put all the stuff away. And of course, I'm all hot and sweaty. So I would then go and take a shower, get all cleaned up, and of course, I'm still hot. So I then would test my mettle and I would just switch it all the way to cold and see how long I could stay in there and cool off. And I don't know. I usually made it like 3 or 4 minutes, maybe. So,
well, that's a lot better if you had it on super hot.
That's
okay. I want
to see
somebody try to withstand super hot water for 3 or 4 minutes.
That's all right. Yeah, actually, there was a thing on. Apparently, I don't remember if it was Germany or Norway, but I saw this thing on Reddit the other day. Yesterday, actually, they used to have a sauna championships.
Really?
Yeah, and basically it was how long you could stay in a sauna. Only the thing was, is they kept turning up the temperature.
Yeah.
And the last year that they did it, they started in like 2003, but the last year they did it was 2010, because the guy that came in third place only came in third place because the second and first place contestants died from being in the 230 degree sauna until their skin melted off.
And it was Liam Neeson who survived.
Liam Neeson who survived, yeah. So, and the guy who did survive, he had third degree burns over almost all of his body. And what it was that they had taken pain medication and then got and used lots of lotions and stuff to keep their skin lube so that they wouldn't feel the heat as much. Which those activities were illegal. These guys actually, they died. And it was some really gross pictures. So, anyway, another film fact about the grave. We just keep going down the dark road. It's the dark road. why do people keep dying in our conversations, Tim? I don't understand.
And you keep reminding me why I never go on Reddit.
Ah, well, that's good. You'll probably lose, you know, a few years of your life that way. So, to create his wolf pack, Carnahan watched hours of nature specials and then apparently threw it all out the window. Okay. He watched hours of nature specials and read tirelessly about wolves. Unfortunately, The Grey depicts wolves that show highly abnormal behavior. But Carnahan, I guess through all of his due diligence, was able to find some extraordinary wolf stories to base his seemingly mythical pack upon, including instances of 250-pound wolves fighting grizzly bears and a story about a 400-member horse-hunting super pack in northern Siberia.
The original super pack.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
They don't need your money. They'll just eat you.
They'll eat you and your money.
Exactly. So, but the interesting thing is that, and I will say that I was impressed with the special effects regarding the wolves, and here we go. And once again, it's because there was a blend. Just like in Jurassic Park, there was a blend. To get the wolves to look just right, Carnahan used trained live animals, acrobats in wolf suits, and huge puppet heads operated by three or four people at a time. All of these elements were then sewn together seamlessly using CGI.
That's the way to do it.
It really is. Because it looked great. It really did. Now, this is one of the things that I think is really, really cool. And kind of goes into not just how badass Liam Neeson is as an actor, but just pretty much how badass Liam Neeson is. During the filming of an emotional scene in which Neeson's character pens a letter to his faraway wife, Carnahan urged Neeson to write the letter to his deceased wife, actress Natasha Richardson. Richardson, the daughter of Vanessa Redgrave and Tony Richardson, died in 2009 from head injuries incurred while skiing. And Carnahan told Vulture why it might just be Neeson's finest performance. Quote, he could draw on real grief. I can't imagine another actor playing it with such depth. He's lived it. He's breathed it. There's nothing fake about that. End quote.
Yeah, the movie definitely captures grief and death and the whole idea of the character suffering and torment, you know, and sadness. So that's interesting.
Yes.
I mean, that's a pretty ballsy move for a director to ask that of an actor.
I think so. I really do. Especially because while really good actors know how to assume a role and or take a role, and then of course you have the method actor who believes that they must literally live the role. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, for the most part, you do draw on experience and stuff, but it's still acting because it's your way of interpreting a character, and then you portray that in the character you play. Where here, it's kind of like, yes, he put a different name to that character, but he's literally channeling himself, and it kind of stops being acting. And at the same time, it doesn't. I guess that doesn't really make sense, but to me it does, and I think it's phenomenal when it can happen that way. So, but the final little factoid is that Bradley Cooper was originally slated to play Neeson's role. Carnahan directed A-Team, which is where Bradley Cooper and Liam Neeson would have been working together, because while they were on the set of the A-Team, Neeson overheard Cooper and Carnahan discussing the project, and that's how he became interested in doing it. So no matter what you have to say about A-Team, one good thing came out of it, and that was the gray.
Exactly.
But I personally liked the A-Team. I think any movie that says they're flying the tank is fantastic. So
it's worthy of enjoyment.
Exactly. So that was my news. I guess a little drawn out there towards the end, but that's what we're here for.
News is news. That's what happens.
That's right.
I mean, Brian Williams even has his drawn out segment, so you're fine, Matthew.
Well, good. Look at that. I can aspire to be Brian Williams. Awesome.
Or NPR.
This is NPR. Yes.
Today on All Things Considered, we have Matthew Quinton.
and all right, Timothy
so
Kuzniar.
I have 185 news pieces to talk about. My first one takes place in the far-off land of London, the UK. And apparently there are five little bastards out there that decided to make a fake movie. It's a fake gangster flick called A Landscape of Lies. And it turns out they're actually paving their own landscape of lies, because Evolved Picture Heads, Bashir Alalissa and Aofi Madan, and again, I'm recording, I'm getting this from HollywoodReporter.com, received terms of 6.5 years and 4 years and 8 months, respectively. I guess to go to prison. Fellow Evolved staffers Tariq Hassan and Osama al-Bakhadi were each sentenced to 4 years, and Ian Sherwood to 3.5 years for their part in this attempted fraud. Now, what fraud are you talking about, Tim? Well, I will tell you, fine people, that these people were planning on making a fake movie to steal taxes, to get a tax break. In fact, a $4.1 million film-related tax fraud attempt these guys were involved in, and that is a lot of money. Quoting again,
Argo, eat your hearts out.
Investigate
what?
What's that?
I said, Argo, eat your hearts out.
Exactly, but these guys actually got caught. Investigators of Britain's Revenue and Customs Service had found that Evolved had never actually planned to make the gangster movie A Landscape of Lies. The men simply used the sham production to try to claim $4.1 million in tax credit and value-added tax, they said. According to investigators, they told their auditors that they had a $29 million budget from a Jordanian firm and that millions of pounds had been sent on it. Boo crap. And apparently they tried to actually make the movie, because I guess they were initially arrested on suspicion of tax fraud in April 2011, looks like. And so they tried to, on a shoestring budget, kind of make this movie to try to pull something together to kind of, you know, cover it up. And how about that? I mean, it's amazing how some government officials, and this isn't just in London, but in the U.S. and Canada, I'm sure, even though you really don't hear about this type of stuff in Canada. But all around, you know, we miss, you know, officials miss or can't locate certain key people. Like, we can't take down a key rich folk, you know, that embezzle money, that kind of create all these, like, pyramid schemes. It takes us a while to get there. But my God, when it comes to five guys trying to make a fake movie, you know, they're just all over it. I mean, it took them a couple years, but holy cow, they got these guys, and I guess they're under arrest, or they have to actually, you know, pay back money, even though they didn't really get the money. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think it's, yeah, I mean, for me, it kind of comes down to, so does that mean that government subsidies for filmmaking, anywhere, not just here or whatever, do you think that they are still a good idea? Because they are susceptible to these kinds. Because there are plenty of movies that do legitimately get made, and they do get help from their respective governments, and then, of course, they make no money.
Right.
So, do you think that they are still, that it's still a good idea then? Because with them being open, susceptible to this kind of fraud, and then, of course, when they don't do well. What do you think?
Well, you're saying if somebody makes a bad movie and gets all these tax incentives and they're not doing well, then, like, what's the point of doing it type of thing?
Right. Well, I don't see, for me, I don't know, because it's a bit of a double-edged sword in this particular regard, because you want to encourage culture, and not all movies are, you know, mindless entertainment. There are really good independent movies and stuff like that.
Right.
So you do want to encourage culture, and of course, when movies get made, even where they're being shot, when they're being shot on location, even if it's only 2 months or 3 months, that's still usually almost one full quarter of tax revenue that local economy gets, not to mention just actual increase in economy, because extra people come in, then they have to have places to stay, then they have to places to eat, all that kind of stuff. So it boosts local economies, even though it's briefly. So there's some money there, but then does the government get the money back if it's a $300 billion success?
It's like what I was talking about with Lord of the Rings, with The Hobbit, is that The Hobbit brought, such a huge crew, and so they boosted the economy in New Zealand, yet they're asking for a piece of the pie because they made so much money. And, you know, I guess they're wanting to sue New Line or sue Peter Jackson or something or another. I mean, it's just, I know it's like there. When it comes to that, that's ridiculous because, you know, Peter Jackson helped the economy out. With these guys, I mean, these guys are bastards.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
They
no,
that's spelled out in the name of the movie, A Landscape of Lies.
No, absolutely. I'm not trying to say that these guys should be let off the hook or by any stretch of the imagination. No, these guys attempted to defraud a government, so they absolutely deserve every little, you know, everything they get. I guess, right. You know, because again, it's a double-edged sword because, you know, because yes, it's good to build culture and yes, it's good to help an economy, but when a movie does make $1 billion, should that tax credit be rescinded? Should maybe they pay it back or should the government just be out? Because yes, like in the case of New Zealand, that has gotten how much tourism thanks to Lord of the Rings? Forget The Hobbit. The Lord of the Rings came out 10 years ago. And how many people go there every year or come back or new trips are planned and they want to go see it? I'm sure there are probably steady businesses that are do nothing but sightseeing tours of the Lord of the Rings. And these are businesses that would not otherwise exist. So
Yeah,
that's a complete, you know, that's definitely they're getting their money back on their investment there.
Well,
I have no...
I don't think, to answer your question, no. I mean, I don't think they would need to pay them back, pay the state back, because when your film is finished, and if it turns out to be not good, there will be another film. There might be other, like five other films coming in behind it that may be, you know, big box office success, you know, films. So I mean, what they might have lost from one film, they could probably gain from another film. I mean, you look at like New Orleans, where New Orleans is kind of a big, becoming kind of a large film kind of area where you see like a lot of movies were shot there. Even the new G.I. Joe movie was shot in New Orleans, awkwardly enough, or interestingly enough. So you have that, and you even have Austin. You have a lot of movies in like Georgia. I think that's where like Tyler Perry has his hub, his studios there. Tyler TP Studios there in Georgia. So I mean, I just think, you know, regardless, they'll, you know, a bigger, better, money raking in project will move in.
So then you think the tax credits are still good?
What's that?
So then you would say that yes, tax credits are still good overall?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that I come down that while it is a double-edged sword because, you know, you do have the possibility to lose that tax money because the film doesn't do well, or, you know, maybe your local government or your state in particular can't afford it, you know, but they do it anyway. I think that overall, that with the potential to do so much for so many places, I think that it is, still a good idea as well. So,
yeah,
cool.
And
okay.
Of news is Will Smith and Django Unchained news, and this Quentin Tarantino Django Unchained news keeps rolling in. It seems like every week, you know, something. You know, interesting or another cool fact about the movie. Well, the idea of Will Smith was in fact supposed to be the character Django, which went to Jamie Foxx. There have been whispers and talks that Will Smith didn't like the subject matter of the script, and that's why he turned it down. In fact, that is not the case. Will Smith probably turned it down for even a more a worse reason, I think, than having just a problem with the meat and grits of the script itself. He had a problem with playing a secondary character. He felt like Christoph Waltz's character, which Christoph Waltz won the Best Supporting Actor for the film. The movie focused more on him and not enough on Django, which, you know, it's kind of a joint movie. And I'm going to go ahead and from IndieWire.com. I'm going to read this little passage real quick. Talking to EW, Smith says that his qualms were not with the violence of the thematic issues, but with the size of the role. Django wasn't the lead, so it was like, I need to be the lead. The other character, Christoph Waltz's Oscar-winning King Schultz, was the lead. I was like, no, Quentin, please. I need to kill the bad guy. Still, he seemed to have enjoyed the finished product. I thought it was brilliant, just not for me. End quotes. So, he wanted to kill the bad guy, which would have changed a lot of the story. It would have screwed over Schultz's character, because the whole idea of him killing, like, Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie, which, on another note, Django kills a lot of effing bad guys.
No kidding.
I mean,
and it really
kills...
was. It's also not even directly Leonardo DiCaprio's character's fault that Broomhilda is where she is. So how does Django need? I don't even understand that logic. Why does it have to be Django that kills him? Why can't it be? Because if it wasn't for King Schultz, Django wouldn't even be there to get his wife in the first place.
Exactly.
So
it's either, I mean, either he just doesn't like playing secondary characters, or it's because he's already going to be playing a secondary character to his son, Jaden Smith, in the M. Night Shyamalan movie, After Earth, which comes out, I guess, this coming summer-ish. And he's also going to be playing a short little cameo piece in this movie called Winter's Tale. So maybe he just knew, like, oh, hey, I'm going to be in a couple movies where I'm not going to be the lead, so I want my lead character in Django Unchained to be even more of a lead character.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems to me that you can't get much more lead than getting the title fucking character's name. Well, I've got this movie called Django Unchained. I'd like you to play Django. Nope, sorry, not big enough.
What? Well, you look at, like, Independence Day, in between, you know, like, Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith, and even Bill Pullman's character, are they not all the lead characters, or is one of them more of a lead than the other type of thing? I mean, it's not like, you know, like I Am Legend, where he's one of, like, three human beings in the entire movie.
Like three people in the movie.
You know? Or like Wild Wild West. So if that movie was made now, would he want a bigger part than Kevin Kline?
I have no idea. I will say this, though. You know, maybe it's serendipity at work, truly providence, what have you. But I don't think that this... I don't think Django Unchained would have been as good with Will Smith as it was with Jamie Foxx. So,
who knows? But it looks like Quentin Tarantino might be doing a... I guess it's a spinoff movie of Inglourious Basterds called Killer Crow. So who knows? Maybe he'll be in that movie, because I believe Quentin Tarantino has been looking forward to working with Will Smith for some time. But moving on,
I don't know. Is the lead character's name Crow? Because if it's not, Will Smith may not do it.
I know. Who knows? I'm not even too sure how the hell it's going to be a spinoff of Inglourious Basterds. The Ring director, and apologies for butchering his name, Hideo Nakata, and this is not the Ring director, excuse me, but the Ringu franchise of movies. We all know those are super... I haven't seen them yet, shame on me, but I know a lot of people who have, and they say they're... Especially the original Ringu is a frightening movie. They're all super gory, and so this director, Hideo Nakata, has been known for making horror-type movies with a lot of grotesque gore, blood... that whole thing, and he was kind of the epitomal person during that big long wave of the Japanese Asian horror flicks that kind of came out in the early 2000s and ended maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago or so, I would think. Because they also did, like, The Grudge as well, which came over here, and Wreck, which I forgot what they called it here, but Wreck's another... Wreck is a Spanish one. I'm going crazy over here. However, another Hollywood Reporter story. Hollywood Reporter asked him at this Okinawa International Movie Festival. They're in Asia. They asked him, "You've said you've never intended to be a horror director." And he responded, "I wasn't really a horror cinephile or anything. I kind of came to be a horror director by accident. And I like to do more... other work in genres. Wes Craven, who of course has made a lot of different kinds of films, once said that when you get the offer to do your second horror film in a row, you have to say no. or you get labeled as a horror director. Of course, I watched films like The Exorcist, which was a huge hit in Japan, which I had no idea, when I was in junior high school, but I was a big horror fan, even though... Oh, excuse me, but I wasn't a big horror fan, and I never thought I'd end up making them. I never really liked the splatter films of the 80s either. I'm not really into grotesque stuff. End quote. So it's very interesting hearing about, you know, kind of like these people that become influential in a way, like whether in a movie, kind of like with Daniel Craig, who does not like guns, is in James Bond. And I think Roger Moore kind of had the same thing. Like, Roger Moore didn't like fighting. He didn't like violence yet. You know, he was in James Bond and kind of was a little rough and whatnot. And all these guys, you know, become well-known for what they never really intended on doing, which I find very interesting because this guy is a good filmmaker. I mean, I've seen bits and pieces of his movies, but now he's wanting to do more, I guess, dramatic movies. And like, we know Wes Craven did that in the 90s. He directed the movie Music in the Heart, which was a Meryl Streep movie where she taught, I guess, these kids violin and makes their lives better.
You know, it's kind of interesting because I think it is a little bit harder for directors than it is for actors, because actors can run the risk of getting typecast just as much as anything else, but I think that if you get a good actor, then they get to play characters that are so far removed from how they really are as a person that the people who know them can't ever confuse them. And then as a fan, if you get to know and understand the actor as a person, then you do know just how good of an actor they are and appreciate them for that even more, because it's like, oh wow, Daniel Craig hates guns, but look at the kind of characters that he plays. That's really interesting. And for me, there might be some people who would say, well, that's a double standard. And I immediately say, it's an actor. They are pretending, you know. And so I think that's really cool when actors can do that. I think, however, that just like an actor can get typecast, I think it becomes easier for directors to get typecast, because with the role of a director, it's not just trying to understand one role. It's not just trying to portray a character. You have to be able to, as the director, understand and execute the vision for the entire movie.
Right.
And when you get good at it in one thing, it's hard to branch away from that, because that's all people want to give you.
Right.
And I think Peter Jackson is a prime example of that. Everybody just went completely ape crap over Lord of the Rings, and they don't want to hear about anything else. Look at his work, I mean, you know, with The Frighteners. And then you take a look, and of course, then King Kong comes out, and it did well, but people are like, oh, it wasn't as good as... It's like, God, you know, give him a chance. Look at the stuff that he can do. And then, of course, what happens? He tries to just executive produce The Hobbit, and where does he end up? In the director's chair.
Yeah, and it also depends on... not only your talent, but how predominant you are within the directing / film / culture of movie goer, critic, whatever community as well. Because if people like you and you're being known for putting out like a quality product, and a lot of people think you're putting out a quality product, and this goes for actors as well as directors, and I would also say with anybody. Above the line people, that, you know, you there's a little bit more leeway in what you want to do. It's like Quentin Tarantino, you know, every movie he puts out is practically a hit that everybody loved, or a number of people really love, and especially his last movie was his highest grossing movie to date. So he can do pretty much whatever he wants, and it seems like after Pulp Fiction and after, mainly probably after, like, Jackie Brown and the first two Kill Bill movies, you know, he's kind of, you know, he can kind of pick and choose his genre, because of who he is and what all he has made for himself, pretty much. So it's the whole Hollywood film. Well, not just Hollywood, but like the whole filmmaking politics of, you know, putting a movie together and what you should do and what people will accept you like what they will accept your work as and how you will reflect your work is very, very interesting. So it's always fun seeing, you know, seeing directors like Paul Thomas Anderson, even like Wes Craven, Peter Jackson, just try to kind of play around with movie making, because it seems like that's what they did in the early 1900s as well, way back to the silent movies. You know, they didn't just make, I mean, some people just did all westerns, and like, you know, John Wayne did a lot of westerns, but every once in a while he'd do, you know, a comedy or a drama that wasn't a western. It was the same kind of thing with directors like Frank Capra, you know, did dramas and he did comedies, and you know, it's just very, very cool, I think, that whole dynamic, how all that
right
works.
On. So, I mean, I guess we kind of broke off a little bit on this. So what was the end result of the article? Is he going to be able to do something? Does he have any projects lined up?
Yeah, he just talks about that he's planning on doing, working on that. Apparently he just finished another horror movie. I'm not too sure what it's called, but just the rest of the article, they were kind of talking about if it was going to get a remake or not, but a U.S. remake or not, so we don't know if that will happen, but yeah, so again, if you guys haven't checked out Ringu, like myself, we should all watch it. Let's all watch it sometime. And I'm going to skip a few of my news articles, save them for next week because of time. So I'm just going to go right into my last one, and it's Bryan Cranston. We all know him as Walt White from Breaking Bad, and if those of you out there that have not seen the show or don't care to watch the show, shame on you.
Yeah,
shame
what the hell's you. The matter with you? Good
you,
Lord.
You have to watch it. It is one of the best. When people say it's the best show on television, it is the best show on television. I mean, every episode is good. It's a great character study. However, Bryan Cranston was doing something or another in New Mexico, and some punk broke his passenger side window and stole a, I guess it was like a satchel or something, and within that satchel he had his iPad, and that iPad had the script for I don't know if it was just for all the episodes of this last section of the season, or if it was one or two or three of the episodes or whatnot, because there's only six left, and they're going to wrap up the entire show beautifully, I hope. Well, somebody stole it, and so he had to call the cops, which is very interesting when you hear it on the news. Because they've been playing it around here in California a lot. Well, I mean, it's just kind of like something that Walt White would do. He's like, hi there. Somebody broke into my passenger side window and stole my satchel. And they're like, well, what is your name? Bryan Cranston. You know, it was just very interesting listening to it. Cause it's like, I can just picture like this happening to Walt White, but instead of his iPod within a satchel, it's like, I don't know, heroin or, you know, meth inside that satchel or something.
I don't think he'd be calling the cops, though.
He'd be calling Saul Goodman,
I guess. Like, and but I do say, I do think that there is still a little bit of a cautionary tale to be had, or a little bit of advice. Never leave your valuables in view. Then you leave your car. You know, put that stuff under the seat. Put it in the trunk. Don't just leave it on the passenger seat, because those are usually crimes of opportunity.
Yeah, and apparently an informant contacted Cranston, told him that he overheard somebody at a bar boasting about having the script for the Breaking Bad TV show. So hopefully they track it down, because this is something that I'm sure a lot of people would be really pissed off at if they knew how it ends. Personally.
Indeed. And thus endeth the news, or is that all?
Yep, or no? That's it.
Well, very good. After that awkward silence there. Then I guess let's jump into Three Squared.
Three Squared, Three Squared.
Three Squared.
Which is more of like a 3x2 thing.
Kind of. Well, with my list, it's going to be all sorts of weird. I guess I'm covering for Mikey. So, Three Squared, for those who might be new or listening or first-timers or what have you. Basically, the idea is that we pick a category, or we pick kind of a style or some kind of weird whimsical idea of something we can give an example of movies for, And in this particular instance, we are doing our favorite sequels. And then the three of us each come up with three examples. Unfortunately, Mikey's not here, so we're not going to have nine. Because you see, three squared is nine. And there would be nine examples. So, now that you understand exactly how it's supposed to work, we're going to go ahead and do it wrong. And here we go. My first one here, I'm way off kilter this week because it's sequels. It's sequels. Last week we did prequels, and there's really not a plethora of prequels to choose from, especially when you get to good ones. But we did it. We managed to pull it off. This week, however, I am having to go to two of the best franchises in history. Because my illustrious partner here has taken just two of the best damn sequels ever in the history of sequels. So,
me?
Yes. So, we'll let him get to his in a minute. Number one, and this is really, this is basically one, two, and three. Number one, number two, number three for me. Number one, Empire Strikes Back. Best sequel of all time. I really think that in terms of being able to achieve what a sequel is supposed to achieve, including the amazing reveal at the end, it does it effortlessly. Not to mention that it really shows just exactly how slow the pacing was in Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. Star Wars gets a pass a lot of... Star Wars gets a pass a lot of the time because no one had ever seen anything like it before, and it was really good and everything like that. And that's fine. All those things are true, clearly. But when you put it up against Empire Strikes Back, it's kind of like watching the first Star Trek movie and then going and watching the second Star Trek movie. You're like, wow, that movie is slow. Holy crap. And even though it was good, it's just really slow. So it does everything that a sequel should do to build upon the story and improve the story and improve the filmmaking along the way. Just classic. So, Empire Strikes Back, number one. Number two for me, favorite sequel, Toy Story 2. This is definitely the best film on the whole of the trilogy. And I will, however, say that there is kind of an offshoot here. I have to at least briefly mention Toy Story 3, because while Toy Story 3 overall is not as good as Toy Story 2 was, it's still a great movie. However, if you had to pick your favorite 15 minutes of cinema, I would have to pick the back 15 minutes of Toy Story 3, especially really probably about the last 12 minutes when they're all holding hands in the pit and they're all about to get melted into scrap. From there on is probably the most heartwarming, tear-jerking, bringing a smile to your face, reminiscent, transport you to your childhood, best 12 minutes of movie that there possibly ever has been. But unfortunately, you can't take 12 minutes a movie and make that the whole thing. So, Toy Story 2 did everything that it should have. It built upon the story. It improved the story. The writing was even better, if it were possible, than it was in Toy Story. And I thought it was nice because it kind of gave Woody the Buzz treatment, you know, because of how everybody was going all ape shit over Buzz in the first movie. And it kind of let Woody have his little time in the spotlight as well. Finally, I have a dead tie for third, because I just simply cannot choose between them. There are so many good things for me about these two movies that they dead tie. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. These are two movies for me. I literally cannot choose between them. Financially, Star Trek IV did better than Star Trek II. Critically received, Star Trek IV did better than Star Trek II. As a Star Trek fan from childhood, growing up on the original series, it was Star Trek II that carried my love of the series into the movies. and then it was Star Trek IV that showed me just exactly how good and how much longevity that Star Trek could truly have. So, from Hell's Heart, I stab at thee, all the way up to Vulcan Pinch of the punk, blaring the punk rock music on the school bus. Just, you know, I'm sorry, it's just, they are my favorite Star Trek movies, and I cannot pick between them. So, dead tie for third. I then have an honorable mention. The honorable mention here is Army of Darkness. I'm sorry, is there just not really one of the... it's just one of the best sequels ever. And if you didn't love Bruce Campbell before Army of Darkness, then you must love him after. And because of, and not in spite of, Army of Darkness. Hail to the King, baby.
Yeah, great, great quotes, especially in Army of Darkness.
Oh, yeah, it's probably one of the most quotable movies ever, you know. Let's get the hell out of here! You know, just it's great stuff all the way around.
Okay, so I also have one of my most favorite quotable movie, but I'm going to say that to the last because that's, I think, my all-time favorite sequel to any movie. So I will go with Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Came out. You see why I was forced to pick Empire Strikes Back, people. I said you see why I was forced to pick Empire Strikes Back. Yeah. Do you see what he leads off with? Okay.
This is what's good whenever you're like the secretary type of person within something. You have to send everybody the email about the schedule for the show to where you can actually go ahead before everybody and put what you're about to say so nobody else can take it. It's wonderful. But Terminator 2, it's just a spectacular movie. Even if you don't watch the first one, which you definitely should, that is James Cameron's first real movie. I don't count Piranha 2 as a James Cameron movie.
Good call.
Terminator 1 also marked the beginning of the woman, the strong woman lead. And James Cameron has a thing about strong women leads in most of his movies, going all the way through to The Abyss, even Avatar, Titanic. I mean, yeah, pretty much all of them. But Terminator 2 can be a standalone movie. Spectacular special effects. Even watching it now, there are some that are still pretty phenomenal. And yep,
I gotta interject here just for one thing.
Do it.
The Abyss. Do you truly think that Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio is the strong woman lead, or just the strong woman that Ed Harris needs because Ed Harris is the lead?
There wouldn't have been a movie without her. Because the whole thing, the reason why he goes down there at the end of the movie is kind of because of her. And they do the whole scene beforehand where he saves her and brings her back to life. Maybe the whole theme of the strong woman seeking justice or seeking hope or just whatever isn't as prevalent in that movie as some of his other movies are, but I would compare that kind of strong, maybe not lead, then strong character to Jamie Lee Curtis's in True Lies, in a way.
Okay.
Because even
Fair
though
enough.
Jamie
Absolutely.
Lee Curtis
you know what?
Is kind of wussy.
Good call.
At the end of it,
yes.
Man, she turns into, she gets pretty beefed up and pretty pissed off and angry.
Very cool. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't. I just
it's cool.
Something I
it's
had
cool.
a question. So carry on.
But Terminator 2, fun movie to watch. I mean, it's one of the. If you think of an action movie, I mean, I have just Terminator 2. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger. There's some good lines in it. There's just cool moments, and it's one of those movies where it's. It's, 2 hours and 10 minutes long, or 2 hours and whatever. It's over 2 hours long. And by the time the movie is over, you look at your watch and just go, holy cow. The movie, seriously? It's already been 2 hours? I mean, it's felt like, the movie just feels shorter because it's just that kind of entertaining movie. At least in my opinion. It's really entertaining.
No, I don't think you will find too many people who would dare disagree with you. There might be people who think it, but I don't think you're going to find virtually anyone who would actually say it.
Yeah, and I think other than The Abyss, Aliens, which is my second one, is my favorite James Cameron movie because it's just that is just... okay, whereas Ridley Scott's Alien is a terrific horror movie. You know, because you never see the alien, and that's what makes the movie so appealing, is because you never see what the creature is. And because how special effects were lacking in technology and whatnot in the late 70s when Alien came out, they had to play around with puppets and not really seeing the monster throughout the movie, which kind of gave it a more creepy feeling. Kind of like what Steven Spielberg did with Jaws when the robotic shark failed to work, I think, every single time they try to get a shot in. But with Aliens, it's more of the science fiction horror movie with probably more science fiction in it than horror, I think. It's just... I mean, the scenery, the look of the movie, the cinematography, the atmosphere in it is just spectacular. It took the atmosphere that Ridley Scott created with Alien, which is, you know, it's a big movie and it's on a big scale, but you look at Aliens, and this is a gigantic scale. I mean, you look at the sets, you look at matte paintings within it to create the landscapes, and also the pods where the aliens come out and suck, you know, on their faces and whatnot. It's just, you know, a phenomenal movie. And Sigourney Weaver is one of the most badass female characters, Ridley, you know, ever, I think. And my last movie is from 1964, and it's a movie that doesn't get as much credit because it's called differently from all its other, like, five sequels. It's the Pink Panther sequel called A Shot in the Dark, the Peter Sellers, Blake Edwards 1964 comedy, which was actually not meant to be a Peter Sellers Pink Panther movie. It's based off a stage play, and it's basically about people die, people get murdered, and the bumbling, goofy Inspector Clouseau is trying to figure out what's going on. And really, when he should be focusing on the pretty, sexy maid, he just thinks it's not her, but really it's probably her. And everybody else can see it, but he is positive it's not her. So comedy ensues throughout the entire movie. I mean, this is the first one where Peter Sellers tries to do the crazy, out-of-control French accent, which adds to the bumbly goofiness of Clouseau. You meet Commissioner Dreyfus, played by Herbert Lorne, as well as Burt Kwonk as Cato as well. Cato! It's just a great movie. Matt, have you seen A Shot in the Dark? Hopefully.
I've actually seen I've seen all the Pink Panthers, all of the original Pink Panthers. I have not seen either one of the Steve Martin ones. The one that I'm missing is the one that was right after he died, where they used cold footage.
Oh, right. Yeah. Curse of the Pink Panther or something. Trail of the Pink Panther.
Yeah. Something like that. That was the only one I didn't watch, because when I found out that it was done from cold footage, I'm like, there's just no way it's going to be good.
Exactly.
So I didn't want. Yeah. But I did want to, when they did Son of Pink Panther, I was rooting for it and I wanted it to do well. And so I did watch that one and it was okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You just can't beat Peter Sellers. I mean, just with the lines he has, like with the Maria Gambrelli character, you know, you can have one of my cigarettes, gives him a cigarette, and he says, "Oh, thank you." She looks at him and says, "You have it in backwards." And his response, "Oh, it tastes very bad that way." It's just hysterical. I mean, it's these Pink Panther movies, especially Shot in the Dark, just how it's shot. It's a good mystery movie, but on top of that, it's a spectacular slapstick, goofy comedy that if you don't know Peter Sellers and if you have no idea who the hell I'm talking about, even if you don't know who the hell I'm talking about whenever I see, say, Blake Edwards, who did Breakfast at Tiffany's, for example, you have to watch the Pink Panther movies, especially the first one, David Niven, is spectacular. So yes, my three are Terminator 2, Aliens, and 1964's A Shot in the Dark, and I threw Evil Dead 2 in there to kind of even out the two James Cameron movies I had back to back. But yeah, three squared, that is all three squared.
Alrighty then, so let's move into the movies. It's movie time
finally.
I guess so.
Keep piddling around here talking about Liam Neeson.
People dying all the time and stuff. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. You know, it's you know, always looking on the bright side of life, Tim. That's what we do.
Well, just so, because it's Easter coming up, you're not going to nail me on a cross or anything, are you?
Actually, according to Jesus, that's the worst way to spend Easter.
It's not that's so right, bad folks. Whenever you think about it. There's kind of a breeze up here.
Yeah, and if it wasn't for the scourging and the crown of thorns and the bleeding profusely all over the place and nailed to a piece of wood, I suppose it's pretty okay.
But with Monty Python, it's hysterical.
Yeah, so at any rate, I guess let's start with Sleepwalk With Me, which is a 2012 independent comedy film. This was written and directed and stars comedian Mike Birbiglia. I gotta say, well, you know what? You wanted to watch this movie, you recommended it, so you go first, Tim. What did you think?
Okay, well, Sleepwalk With Me is based off Mike Birbiglia. Yeah, Birbiglia's one-man show, and also they did, I guess, an NPR kind of show about it a couple years ago. And it's basically about this guy who becomes a comedian, and along the way of becoming a semi-successful comedian, he realizes that he doesn't really belong in a relationship with his girlfriend who wants to get married and have babies. He's growing detached from her. And he has a problem with sleepwalking as well. And the sleepwalking kind of ties in with his productivity and becoming a... just kind of like guiding him through life in a way. Is that a good way of kind of explaining it?
Well, I think that it's not just sleepwalking. It's literally called REM, sleep behavior disorder. And essentially, like, if you dream that you're a superhuman lifting up a car, okay, it will tie into your actual ability to, in a panic, lift up a car, because your body doesn't produce enough, I guess it's dopamine or whatever, to keep you at rest. And it's triggered by basically denial of stress in your real life. It works its way through your body when you're sleeping. So as he continues to deny or live in denial about the problems in his life, his sleepwalking gets worse.
Right. And, yeah, so that's pretty much the movie. And I don't want to give away the ending because the movie turns out to be much more than a comedy. To me, it's a real-life movie. It has a lot of heart and a lot of thought. I feel sad for the guy because he's growing away from his girlfriend. And though I feel sad for him, he knows he'll be happier if he breaks up with her and whatnot. The story touches on life. It touches on love. It's what I call a piece of life story where this is a fragment of life that happens to a lot of people. I mean, I've kind of been there in a way before, not the same situation, but. The whole idea of thinking you care for somebody or wanting to care for somebody, but really you belong going down a different path where you know you'll be happier, and with doing so, the other person will be happier. However, you don't want to leave that person because you don't want to make them mad. And this is what the ending of the movie kind of culminates to, is that they didn't want to break up because they didn't want to make each other mad. Now, what's the point of...
I thought you didn't want to give away the ending.
Okay, spoiler alert. but it's just this is definitely one of those movies that it's not about the end product. It's about the journey, about how his character becomes what he does end up becoming at the end of the movie, and just how everything just happens between the two of them. Because you feel, I mean, these are real life human beings, and I guess it really hit me in a way because this is something that actually happened to Mike Birbiglia.
Mm-hmm. Birbiglia.
Yeah, he wrote the movie, obviously, and he directed the movie, and he is starring in the movie. So it's a very good movie with a very good message. And again, that message is, you know, why stay with somebody just because you don't want to make each other mad type of thing. The pacing I enjoyed. It lets the jokes play out in a very natural way. With saying that, some jokes fail. I mean, it's kind of obvious that he's not a trained kind of like actor in a way, but still he gets the feeling of real life, you know, throughout the entire movie. You know, you just feel like you're just watching his past in a very awkward way, especially when he's narrating it, you know, just driving through the toll booth and just talking to the camera as he's driving and all that stuff. It's just, yeah, I guess I was just very fascinated with the movie. And I will say this, that when it premiered last year at numerous film festivals, it's been on a lot of top 10 lists, and it took home a lot of honorable mention awards, and a lot of awards, and a lot of critics and audience awards. So, yeah, if you're into movies that could possibly have been from or could possibly become an NPR story, then this is definitely for you. What'd you think about it, Matt?
Okay. I think that I would have enjoyed this movie if I didn't already know everything about it.
Yeah.
When Tim suggested this movie, I was initially against it. However, since Mikey hadn't seen it and Tim hadn't seen it, and I actually had not seen the movie, my thing was is that I already knew everything it was about, because he had this is based on the movie is based on a one man show from Broadway, which is based on a stand up which is based on his life, and of course because it's part of his life, through his stand up he was featured on This American Life describing the events that essentially culminate the movie. And so it's like, enough already. It's kind of like, it makes me feel a little bit bad for comedians in a way, because much as the singer who or the band or whatever that goes on tour and has to sing the same song over and over and over again every night, you know, because they're on tour, you know, it kind of made me feel bad for Mike Birbiglia, because it's kind of like, dude, do something else. You know, but on the same token, it's, you've got to expose your comedy and you've got to expose your story and the way that you perform to as many people as possible. So you have to tell the same jokes over and over and over again. And so his life led to those jokes, which led to the stand-up routine, which led to the, you know, show, which led to the book, which led to the American Life, which led to the movie. And it's all the same thing. So I really didn't want to watch it. However, you know, I manned up. I watched this movie. On the merits of filmmaking, I have to agree with Tim. It is a good movie. If I hadn't known anything about this movie, I probably would have laughed a lot more than the one time that I laughed. And the funniest line in this movie, I waited about an hour and 5 minutes for it to happen, but it was worth it, I think, is... he's kind of he's kind of in this you're not sure if he's dreaming or not, and this girl who is not his girlfriend is wanting to make out with him, and he's, you know, oh, I've got a girlfriend or whatever, and she's like, so you mean you're gonna you're gonna deny yourself the experience of the now? And he's just kind of like, yeah, I guess so. I about died. I thought that was the funniest thing of the whole movie.
He just nailed the deadpan kind of line.
Yeah, and so again, he does a good job. The acting is pretty solid. Clearly, the writing is there. I was surprised to find out that he directed it. I didn't know that he directed it. And I think I will give him another chance if he decides to do another movie down the road. I just hope it has absolutely nothing to do with anything regarding his stand-up. Because, again, this movie is good. I recommend you watch it. A personal rating is 3.5. But had I not seen this stuff before, I probably would have given it 4 stars anyway. So does that help? Is that a little bit too ambiguous?
No, it's honest.
Yeah. It's a good movie. It's just kind of like I knew it all before it happened, so it wasn't as fun for me to watch.
Yeah.
So there you go. Okay, so next is 30 is one of the 30 for 30 films. It's a series that ESPN does where they had 30 different movies, 30 different documentaries from 30 different directors. And of course, the series was so good that ESPN kept it going because it's all sports in nature. And the episode in particular that I had recommended is called Broke, which is the number one in the most recent series, but it's the 44th film overall. And so I guess they should call it, you know, 60 for 60 now. I don't know. This particular one is called Broke, and basically it's just it's an exploration into how the hell someone can lose $100 million. And it's all these sports figures, you know, and it's not a, this is not a documentary that has them saying, please feel sorry for me. They don't do that. None of them say, oh, I'm so hard, I'm hard up, and oh my, here's my hard luck story. And there's not a single one of them say it, but every single one of them tells you, you know, if you were a 21-year-old kid who'd never had anything and did not understand the concept of money, one day, and then the next day someone hands you a $500,000 check, how long do you think you'll hang on to it? You know? And then, of course, there are even the people who, you know, made hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars, and then, and how they just blow the money, and you're like, oh, I would never do that. And it's like, well, you know, you're watching this as someone who's in your mid to late 20s, or me in mid 30s, and it's like, well, of course you wouldn't, because you know you're 30 years old or whatever, and you have an idea of what it takes to run a household or how it is to, you know, manage your money to a certain degree. And I just found it completely fascinating of all these different stories from, and it's not just football. It was football. It was, there was hockey, baseball, basketball. You know, it was stories from all these different sports about people who lost millions of dollars. And it definitely gave me a new appreciation for it. And not necessarily for their plight, so to speak, but to be able to say, well, what would I do if I was truly in their shoes? And mom came up to me and said, you know, I'm going to lose my house if you don't give me $20,000. You know, would you put your mom on the street?
No.
And that's why I thought this one was so good, and that's why I recommended it. What did you think, Tim?
Yeah, it was very interesting. I mean, it's interesting seeing how, I mean, the focus was football, and just seeing also how the type of class of kids that they recruit for football than they would with, I think more so with basketball than they would with like hockey, is different, because you have the lower income kids coming from households where they didn't have to worry about holding on, like they wouldn't have to worry about a financial holding on to a large sum of money. And whenever, like kind of what you were saying, whenever they get put into the situation where they're given a $500,000 signing contract bonus or whatever, and they blow it all on five cars, they don't think about taxes, they don't think about this, they don't think about that, they don't think about putting some money into savings or anything like that. What all matters to them is, you know, is their bling and stuff. And what I appreciated in the movie is how they talked about, and this is where it kind of segregates how this affected more so, I think, the African American community than the Caucasian white community, I guess, is that there was a time during the 1990s where they had rappers. And they had songs in the culture. The black culture was showing up one another. If you had money, then you spend the money. It's all about girls and women and owning fine jewelry and eating at the finest restaurants and doing this and basically just showing yourself off to you know, I guess to have friends or try to have friends or, you know, whatever you call friends. And later on, they realize that they got screwed over because not only did they lose their money, but the people that they thought were their friends, doing little quotation thingies right now, they're not really their friends. They're really assholes that was just using them for their money. So it's just kind of, it's fascinating hearing those stories and hearing about the people that ended up catching it in time. So they were able to take what they had left and build up the, you know, build on that and become successful doing something else whenever they retire. Because after they retire, that's no more money. I mean, excuse me, whenever they retire, they get some money. But if they get hurt or if they get kicked off the team before retirement, they don't get anything. I mean, that's it. They get maybe like a little, like a $100,000, $30,000 for a bonus, but, you know, that's it. Still, you have to deal with taxes. So, and then you look at, say, like Dionne Warwick, I just heard about today. She owes, $20-25 million for taxes or just not managing her books for the past 20 years or so. But all of her assets are only worth $25,000. So she owes millions of dollars, but she only has thousands of dollars. So, I mean, she's pretty much broke. So it's just, it's very interesting. And I was telling Matt earlier that I thought it was, the movie was long. But thinking about it now, it just has a lot of information and a lot of interesting information that really kind of tells the story of what some of these people went through. And again, some people came back from it. Other people did not. And it's kind of sad, in a way, watching about how many people's lives were ruined, either by mismanagement or getting screwed over by even their parents. One guy did, so.
Indeed.
Well, good.
Well, I'm at least glad you found it informative.
And, yeah.
You know, I was really hoping that you wouldn't think it was too long. I mean, it was an hour and 17 minutes.
No, I know. It was just, it kind of just rehashed the same thing kind of over and over again. But,
gotcha.
But, you know, they had a lot of people talking about it, so it was, you know, it was very informative.
In a good way. All right, so then the last movie that we have is Breakdown, the 1997 thriller that starred Kurt Russell, J.T. Walsh, and Kathleen Quinlan, yeah, more or less.
From Apollo 13, the wife.
Well, I know, just kind of less. she really wasn't in the movie for, like, you know, but 6 minutes, I guess, 6-7 minutes. So basically, this movie is Kurt Russell and Kathleen Quinlan play some on the surface well-to-do people moving, changing jobs. So they're going cross-country in a brand new Jeep Grand Cherokee, and they basically, Kurt Russell's driving. Kathleen Quinlan is playing his wife. She's asleep in the passenger seat, and he's digging around for something in the back seat, and he cuts off these, I guess, rednecks or whatever. And so they're moving along doing their thing, but it comes out in conversation that even though on the surface they appear to be well-to-do, they're actually in some severe financial straits, or dire financial straits. And so they're really needing this job to work out. And so they stop for gas, and they meet up with the guys that they ran off the road, and they kind of get into a little bit of an altercation, but nothing serious, because, you know, Kurt Russell backs down because he's just a normal dude and he's not looking for any trouble. So they leave the gas station, and eventually the car breaks down. And a friendly truck driver pulls up, 18-wheeler driver, and he's like, hey, you know, I can get you down the road, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, nah, I don't want to leave the car here. You know, I don't want to leave the car. And so his wife's like, well, honey, why don't you stay here in the heat, and I'll go and get in the truck and go down to the diner and call for a tow truck. He's like, okay, that's fine. That you know, this guy seems nice enough. And that is when the movie kind of starts, because he never comes back, no one shows up, he ends up seeing that the car is mysteriously very easy to fix, goes to where the wife is supposed to be, and she's not there. And so now, it's on. He's got to figure out what happens, and then, of course, it's, you know, there's a kidnapping scheme mixed in with extortion, and there's ransom, and it's very, very 90s thriller. It is a quintessential 90s thriller. I said stereotypical earlier. Yeah, I did say stereotypical earlier when Tim and I were talking about it, but what I meant to say was quintessential. It is the quintessential 90s thriller. And it does a really good job of setting up the story, and it does a really good job of utilizing all of the characters and kind of bringing it together to tell a pretty cool story and how it all and how it kind of plays out. The music is definitely, I think it tries a little too hard to show you that you're supposed to be, oh, it's so suspenseful, but I think that's more of a 90s cliche than it is the movie's fault. The one thing that I will say is that the end, the last 15 minutes of the movie really kind of destroys the whole thing. It's not the ending itself, you know, whether it's, I'm not going to spoil it for you if you haven't seen it or not. It's not that the ending is too happy or too sad or doesn't work out the way you think it should. It's just that it seems to go way overboard in terms of ridiculous amounts of action that the characters they've worked so hard to create and make believable and portray in a good way, in a believable way, which they do up until the last 15 minutes of the movie. You've got a yuppie who turns into Mel Gibson a la Lethal Weapon. And it's like, what? So, you know, it just gets a little bit too crazy by the end of it. Exploding cars and trucks flipping over. And you're just kind of like, wait a minute. When did this switch from a thriller to an action movie? And so that really, the last 15 minutes kind of killed it for me. I still say that I gave the movie 4 stars overall based on when it was made. And I would definitely say it's worth checking out, but don't expect a ton from the ending.
Yeah, this was seems like one of Kurt Russell's last kind of movies that I can think of. I mean, other than like Death Proof, and he did Leaving or Return to LA or Leaving Los Angeles or Escape from LA. Yeah, he did that around the same time. But if this movie were made now, this would have Liam Neeson all over it. I think it would have Liam Neeson all over it, because Kurt Russell, in my opinion, was the original badass when it came to movies. I mean, he's a good looking guy. He's a charming guy. He is a funny guy, and he just knows how to deliver lines, I guess. And the director of this movie is Jonathan Mostow, and he directed U571, among a few other movies. But this is my favorite one of his, because it's a very tactful movie. And even back in the reviews that came out in 96, 97, the movie came out, even a lot of the critics were even calling this movie, saying that it's very skillful, that it's an even old-fashioned type of movie that Roger Ebert even said about. So it had the old-fashioned feel to it, where no special effects. I mean, it didn't rely on all-out car chases, where the car chases were super long and it was just utter crazy massive destruction and chaos until the last, you know, 5-4 minutes of the movie or whatnot. But it's a very intriguing piece of storytelling, because you had the characters that are in it. I mean, it's not just there's a good guy and there's a bad guy and there's a situation. You actually have the storyline. You have the creepy town folk that may or may not be in on the plot. You have the bad guy, who's the stone cold faced bad guy played by spoiler alert, I guess. Since this is an older movie, I mean, I'm probably going to spoil a couple things. Bad guy played by J.T. Walsh. He's just like the bad guy. And what's cool about like all the hillbillies that Kurt Russell encounters is that they are hillbillies. I mean, nothing really ages in this movie because these hillbillies look exactly like the hillbillies now, the rednecks of now. So I mean, it could, if you are prone to be freaked out by movies where you might get kidnapped or murdered or something like this, this might even be one of those movies. If you're driving down Arizona and something happened to your car and you see a tow truck, you know, coming by, you might want to, you know, not flag them down or anything like that. Just let them, you're probably better off just walking the 5 miles to town or whatever. Probably not, but just saying. But yeah, so the movie has a good old-fashioned storytelling element to it. As a tactful movie, like I said, I just loved how things happen and things play out, and how Matt didn't care for the last 15 minutes because of how Kurt Russell's character developed. I enjoyed it because you just already knew whenever he jumps on the back of the 18-wheeler when he's being taken to this barn, you just know that something, you know, it's just his character is going to be more prone to doing a car chase or just doing something super action-packed. Even whenever he does the whole, pulls out the gun to the guy in the truck, the pickup truck, the other hillbilly guy, you just know that there's something within the character that can take him to the edge that, you know, he is taken to at the end of the movie.
Well, that part was okay because he was still playing the, you know, the desperate husband driven to the edge of his senses there.
Right.
It's after that whole scene plays out, that's when it gets ridiculous. Come on, you're telling me that essentially a yuppie, okay, is going to be able to do the hanging military crawl underneath the bottom of that truck and cling to the side of it and climb up the side. I mean, come on.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying, but after that, you know, after seeing that, I was able to enjoy the rest of the movie because of him seeing, you know, crawling underneath the truck and doing all that thing. That's what I was, you know, I just knew after that, you know, anything can happen. The possibilities are endless. And I got to tell you one last thing about this movie, and I'll shut up about it, is that the death of the bad guy. And I remember watching this movie back in 97 or 98, whenever it came out on VHS. I loved how this bad guy died. I mean, it was the, in my mind, like the ultimate way to get payback, to produce payback on somebody that just almost ripped your life into shreds. And I'm not going to say what happened, but I would imagine it being super duper painful on multiple levels. And yeah, I mean, it kind of reminded me of Duel in a way, the Spielberg's first movie, Duel. You know, instead of it just being the bad guy in the truck, the bad guy is on legs. So it's pretty much Duel on feet. Duel on foot, I'll call it, is breakdown. But yeah.
I don't know. See, okay, I won't spoil the ending in and of itself either. Okay, for the, again, because you know, once you see the movie. But the fact that he has to die the way he has to die, okay, when he actually does die, is so ridiculous.
It is
ridiculous.
I mean,
come on.
Yeah, I mean,
it's ridiculous. After all that, then the final blow comes. I mean, see, that, again, was for me. I just, like, oh, come on, for real?
But isn't that how a lot of 90s action movies are, though?
Again, I don't know, because
you look at even like True Lies, for example, like how, you know, by the end of that movie.
Well, again, but True Lies was designed to be that way,
right?
Whereas Breakdown for me was not. It's a thriller that turns into basically a bastardized action movie by the last 15 minutes. Whereas it could have done so much more with the thriller aspect of it all the way through up to the end. I don't think it needed to go where it went for the last 15 minutes. For me, okay, if Wikipedia page here, for whatever it's worth, says, Roger Ebert gave the film a positive review, calling it, quote, taut, skillful, and surgically effective, end quote. Although he felt the, quote, ending is unworthy of it, end quote. That's if I have to sum it up in a sentence, there you go.
Right.
The ending is unworthy of it.
I just can't pass up a good death. They don't kill bad guys like that anymore, Matt. They don't.
Well, maybe that's because they spent the last 40 years killing bad guys this way. they're kind of done. I don't know. I still say overall, I agree with Tim. See the movie.
Yeah.
If nothing else, see it for Kurt Russell. He does a great job. And then J.T. Walsh, of course. And this was the last movie that he was alive for the release of. He died about 2 or 3 months after this movie came out.
Right.
So, yeah. All right. Well, there we go. Oh, I think that...
The end of the show.
It wasn't too painful this time, I think. Let's see. So for next week, the 3 Squared is going to be... What movies do not exist in your eyes? I'm going to give one as an example because I believe that this movie should not exist. However, this will not be on my list next week. M. Night Shyamalan's The Last Airbender. That movie doesn't exist. Sorry, movie doesn't exist. What movie? M. Night Shyamalan's
The Last Airbender? Don't know.
What? That's Aaron? Right. So what movies do not exist in your eyes? That's the 3 Squared for next week. The movies for next week are going to be G.I. Joe Retaliation, which is a last-ditch, desperate attempt to redeem this franchise and attempt to get it its one final installment. Basic and The Vanishing, which, since we have been discussing Breakdown, this The Vanishing is in a very similar vein of thriller style of movie. So,
right,
and it also came out in 93 versus 97.
Right, and I'll also be watching Cosmopolis, and I'll be doing my own little spiel about that, I guess.
Yes, and I know that you are looking forward to that.
I am.
All right, so then I guess that brings us up to the spiel. Yes, is it time for the spiel?
Yes.
All right, so the spiel then goes a little something like this. The music that you've been listening to has, as always, been provided to us by Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at MySpace and Facebook.com, /Cries of Solace. You can check us out, if you're interested in doing so, by sending us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @theslscast. You can also go to our website, slscast.com. You can even subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and if all else fails, you can go to Facebook and search for The SLS Cast and find us there too. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and we hope to hear from you, and peace out.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, @theslscast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.